connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Hello, it's a me, middle-aged working man. You'll never guess who voice acts me.
Ah, and it's a me, the evil working man of middle age. Let me just check the script to see who voices me. Oh my god, I'm not in this movie.
You want movie? Wario give you movie.
and then a floating Wario head comes out and eats Chris Pratt.
Yeah, so in case you haven't noticed or heard or been on the internet, there is some breaking news that we're delivering roughly a week later than it broke, which is the cast of the Mario movie, the Illumination Mario movie, mind you, not the old live-action one.
The movie that I feel
like a lot of people remembered was said to be a thing, but had forgotten about until Nintendo was like, hey, remember that we're making a Mario movie?
And everyone collectively went, oh yeah, you were. Who's going to be in it? And Nintendo went, hold on to your fucking seatbelts.
Yeah, we've got Chris Pratt as Mario, the Rat Man himself.
Yes, yes,
which is
Chris
relevant
Pratt.
To today's topic. Yeah. It's like, so, okay, so that's, he's Mario. Just, I want to go over the cast off the top real quick. We've got Charlie Day as Luigi. Anya Taylor-Marie, is that it?
Anya Taylor-Marie.
Okay, yeah. As Peach. We've got Jack Black as Bowser. We've got Seth Rogen as Donkey Kong. Keegan-Michael Key as Toad, and God, there's, oh yeah, I know Fred Armisen is Cranky Kong.
Yeah, Fred Armisen is fucking Cranky Kong. Kevin Michael Richardson as Comic. Kevin Michael Richardson, well-established video game voice actor, actually, as well as like TV voice actor for like Disney, done voices on Milo Murphy's Law, or like The Owl House. Just like probably the only person on this entire list who like has the chops to be a voice actor.
Okay, Jack Black has plenty of voice acting credits, though. Let's be honest.
All right, that's fair. That's fair.
He is. He's been in video games many times.
And Sesame Street.
Yes, of course. He was in Psychonauts 2.
Ah! And he was also on an episode of iCarly.
And he was on an episode of Mr. Show.
Jack Black deserves to be...
He deserves to
in
be
this
Bowser.
Movie.
He's a gamer.
Yeah.
He has a gaming YouTube channel. I gotta say, though, so, like, I don't... It's so hard to talk about these, because, like... On one hand, it does feel like they just got, like, random celebrities drawn from a hat to play the characters. But on the other hand, some of them would be fun. Like, I can understand Seth Rogen as Donkey Kong. Maybe not quite the TV show Donkey Kong, which I've grown to love personally. But understandable, I guess. And Keegan-Michael Key as Toad could be very funny. I have faith in him that he'll be able to bring something new to the character. The question is, so, like, for one thing, with Charlie Day Luigi, if he's written at all like the slightly unhinged Super Show Luigi, I'll be fine. I think if they take inspiration from that, then it could fit Charlie Day. But if it's, like, I don't know if the video game, like, Luigi's Mansion-style Luigi would really fit him, but it's hard to say without watching the movie. I'm used to Charlie Day having, like, one speed that his characters go at, you know?
Yeah. Charlie Day, if you aren't entirely aware, probably most famous being an It's Always Sunny character.
Yeah, he plays Charlie Kelly in It's Always Sunny.
Yeah, and you would probably recognize like his most famous bit as the Pepe Sylvia bit, the character of him like explaining a fucking, you know, red twine conspiracy theory board.
Yeah. Which, of course, ends in his co-star going, okay, those people are real, and they've been wanting their mail for 2 days. It's a good bit. But yeah, Chris Pratt is Mario.
Yeah, Chris Pratt is Mario, and that's kind of the one that I think most people have been really focusing on.
Yeah.
So for one thing, Chris Pratt as a celebrity has gone through turbulence. Like, what was generally a well-regarded person, and then kind of got, like, kind of became the Twitter, kind of got milkshake ducked, as the current lexicon would say. And so, you know, been a bit, like, needing to reclaim his status with sort of our younger generation. But, like, he's also Star-Lord. He's really famous.
Yeah. He's like the hot actor right now, not in terms of body type, but in terms of just like popularity in the studio's perspectives. Because, like, yeah, Star-Lord, obviously, Guardians, good movies. He portrays the character well. But he was also in the Jurassic World series, which is the spinoff of Jurassic Park. He kind of got his start as Andy in Parks and Rec, and he does a good job playing that character and kind of embodying that character. But, like, it's definitely really weird seeing that and then just, like, seeing him now. He was in that, like, Tomorrow War movie that I saw a bunch of advertisements for and didn't really understand the point of. But yeah, like, I don't know. I think the thing about Chris Pratt also is that Mario has, like, two voices. There's Brooklyn voice and Italian voice. And I can't really picture Chris Pratt doing either.
Yeah, like,
maybe it's because he's, like, cast all the time as Midwesterners, but I picture him in that Midwestern accent and not in the, like, "Hey, Luigi, we gotta go down to the Princess Toadstool's Mushroom Kingdom."
Yeah, like, celebrity voice acting in animated movies has been a topic of, like, consistent sort of annoyance with, like, film buffs, I suppose. And I think definitely part of it is that Chris Pratt as Mario was the first release, and so, like, just, like, that felt like a brick being dropped on your head.
Yeah.
from 20 stories. Like, And then just, like, you know, you get Anya Taylor-Joy as Peach, and it's like, oh, okay, she was good in The Queen's Gambit. And then you get fucking Charlie Day as Luigi, Jack Black as Bowser, Keke Michael Key as Toad. Like, it's just back to back of, like, holy shit, this movie is either going to be the best or worst thing ever.
Again, there's a lot of voice actors. Okay, so let me put it like this. It feels like for a lot of characters, they just went with a celebrity and not necessarily a voice actor, which is sort of the problem people have a lot of it. But, like, there's definitely some voice actors I could think of that would be better in some roles. I personally feel like you could see a good Mario from, like, Rob Paulson, maybe?
Yeah.
If you're going for the Italian Mario. Brooklyn Mario, you have a lot of options. Danny DeVito being the meme, but like, Chris Pratt is just so far from the character. It's not like hasn't done voice acting before, because he was, is it Emmett from the Lego movie?
He was Emmett in the Lego movie, so, like, he has chops,
but not, like, Mario chops.
Yeah, Mario is like the video game guy. When you think video games, you think Mario. It's like if people were like, you know, oh, we're gonna make a movie about, I don't know, Abraham Lincoln, you know, the president, the, like, one of the biggest presidents you think of, and we're gonna cast Chris Nolan Pratt. North. Yeah, it's
like if you were to make a movie about Napoleon, you know, one of the generals in history. And you cast Chris Pratt as Napoleon.
Hey guys, I'm Napoleon. I'm a short. Let's a go. That's my Chris Pratt impression.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sent the whole internet into a storm.
Yeah, it Oh man. I'm looking forward to this, honestly. I think this is, I am super super excited for this, to be quite honest.
Look, I unironically enjoyed the Sonic movie. Don't know if, how that will reflect on this. I kind of hope this is worse, but in like a so bad it's good way, because that would be funny. If it's good and everyone is surprised by that, then sure, that's cool. But I'm setting my expectations real low, which is to say they're high in a low sense. If it's just mediocre, then I'm going to be disappointed. But, you know, that's just how movies are for me a lot of times.
Yeah, honestly, like, I hate to make the cold shot, but, like, this is Illumination we're talking about. And, like, yes, Nintendo, I don't know how it's being produced. I am willing to bet that, like, Nintendo is basically, like, having oversight, but, like, a lot of the decisions are going to kind of just be Nintendo, like, writing, you know, they go out, somebody comes up to Shigeru Miyamoto and is like, hey, we got the newest thing from Imagination. He's like, sign, name, cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then relaxes on his, you know, throne made entirely of unreleased copies of Mother 3.
Okay. Okay, called shot time. Will the Goombas talk? Yes or no?
Ooh, I am willing to bet not the Goombas. I'm willing to bet a lot of Koopas are going to talk.
Right, yeah.
And it's going to be, like, it's going to be low-level voice actors that, like, actually do voice acting for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It's a living. We're,
maybe, you know what? Here's my one called shot. Alex Hirsch is going to voice a...
Richard.
How about a Lakitu?
A Lakitu, okay.
There, that is my big called shot.
Here's my shot. Matt Chapman is going to voice a Thwomp. Just pulled that out of thin air. But you gotta admit, Matt Chapman would make a good Thwomp.
Matt Chapman would make a good Thwomp.
Chapman, Ratman... I think Ratman. It's time to talk about our current topic. So, that's the fun. So, okay, so...
That's the segue. So, hey, welcome to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride to the World Wide Web. I'm your co-host, Matt. We didn't...
Whoops! Yeah, we ended up taking a bit longer on the intro than we first thought, but it's time to actually talk about what the topic of this episode is. I hope you like fact corners, because this is going to be 90% fact corner. The corner has kind of grown into the size of a fact room. A fact-ory, if you will.
A fact octagon.
Fact-octagon?
Factagon.
Yeah, so...
The fact corner.
So, also, if you would like to see... Some good comedy. Google It's a Me Mario Chris Pratt, because he put out like a funny Twitter video of him doing a really deadpan It's a Me Mario, and it's been memed to death, but it's quite good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so yeah, today's topic.
Yeah, so in October we'll be talking about things that are ARG adjacent, and so today, the last day of September, we are going to talk about what an ARG is by talking about one specific ARG, as well as sort of the history of the genre. Specifically, in October, we'll be talking about something that is an ARG, something that's dubiously an ARG, and something that is not an ARG, but is sort of, but not also, and also gets confused as one. And so we feel like we should take some time to sort of define this. And the one we've chosen for today is one that I was personally around for the whole time, or like, you know, from start to finish of it. And so it's the one I have the best recollection of, and it is the one that Galen has no recollection of.
Yes. I had heard about this ARG, but I never participated. And the extent of me knowing about it is knowing it existed.
Yeah. So, what is an ARG? ARGs are short for alternate reality game. An alternate reality game is a mixed media interactive fiction sort of experience. It's hard to exactly pin down what an ARG is in its entirety. There's not really a good definition that sort of includes all of it, but think of it like a mix between a role-playing game at like wide scale, a puzzle hunt, and like viral marketing.
Yeah.
So essentially what it is there is a story presented, and it is presented in the form of like things that are made to look real, and the players get sort of involved in the story by researching it, solving puzzles, piecing together clues, finding more bits of story, and eventually it leads to some sort of finale, as stories often do. Now, the important thing is that the story is often told through many different forms of media. Stuff like phone calls, emails, websites, real-life events and flyers and posters and stuff like that. And the puzzles are along the cryptographical sense, cryptographic sense. They involve things like ciphers, knowing things like binary or hex or ASCII, knowing how to use software to do things like read spectrograms or look at metadata. And sometimes they also just involve like calling a number and going through a phone tree and then doing what the phone tree tells you to do.
Yeah. So like to give a very basic example, the introduction to what probably is the most well-known ARG, The Beast. The Beast was an ARG for AI, the Steven
Spielberg.
Steven Spielberg movie. And during the trailer of AI, there is, I believe, a billboard that has a phone number. And when seeing the trailer, some people thought, what if that was a real phone number? And they called it. But the interesting thing is that if you call it, it actually has a voicemail. And the person on the voicemail is like, you know, hey, sorry, I can't get to the phone right now. You can find me on my website, blah, 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 .com. And I think there's another message, like, she also says, like, and, you know, if you're Jamie, please call my personal cell. If you go to that website, it is a real website. And you can search the website, and if you find, you know, a certain tab, you get to another phone number that you can call, and it goes from there. It's like the fiction of the story pretends as though it is part of this real world, but like the end goal of it is mystery solving, cryptographs, you know, a lot of like esoteric knowledge, right, to get a community get together to solve.
Right. And eventually this led to real life events like real life protests for robot rights, because the storyline of The Beast involved like a robotic boat that was suspected for murder. Yeah, just to give sort of an extended history, The Beast is sort of credited as the first ARG as we know it today, but it itself was inspired by a few other things. There was an internet urban legend called Ong's Hat, which was named after a ghost town in, like, New Jersey, I think, maybe Michigan. And that had this element of people making pilgrimages to the ghost town as sort of participating in the urban legend. And then also there was a hacking sort of game made by Wizards of the Coast to promote their Netrunner card game. And additionally, there were two more key elements. There was the marketing campaign in 1999 for the Blair Witch Project, which was sort of made to make the movie look like it was a real thing. But most importantly, the creators of The Beast said that they were inspired by the Paul is Dead conspiracy, of how people were able to piece together what seemed like clues from practically nothing, from like taking, you know, oh, this tiny detail on this picture points to this, and if you play this song backwards, it's this. The ability to find hidden messages, even when they're not meant to be there, inspired them to create things with hidden messages that were there.
Yeah.
So the creators of The Beast went on to form a studio called 42 Entertainment. And they're also behind many of the other, like, great ARGs in history. So, for example, they did I Love Bees for Halo 2, which was about an AI from Halo getting sent back in time and corrupting a website of a beekeeper. That one, I believe, involved, like, ringing payphones you had to pick up and listen to at some point. There was Why So Serious for The Dark Knight, which had real-life Harvey Dent political campaigns. There was Year Zero for Nine Inch Nails, which had people find, secret demo cassettes in bathroom stalls at concerts. And I just think this is interesting. They did one called Last Call Poker that involves playing poker in cemeteries for the video game Gun.
Yes. Oh my god, I was going to specifically call this one out. Okay, Gun. Gun is a Neversoft game in 2005, 2006, I believe. Not gonna look it up. But I own that game. It's used to be one of my favorite games. It's pretty much purely nostalgia at this point. Kind of a problematic game. But it had its own ARG. I found out about that ARG, 10 years after it was a thing. And it is completely undocumented. I think I found, one blog that half documented some things, but it is basically lost ARG media.
Yeah.
And that upsets me so much.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring up that the topic today we're talking about, I had to find an internet archive for the wiki that covered the game or the ARG. ARGs were big in the early 2000s when there was a lot of kind of earlier internet stuff. A lot of, forums and things like that. But not all of those got backed up, and so some of the information is really hard to find or impossible. Also, in sort of the mid-2000s to late-2000s, we started to see more independent ARGs. One of the notable ones from this area was... this era was Lonely Girl 15, series that started as, what looked to be a normal vlog series, and eventually kind of grew into this fiction surrounding a cult. And the one that's probably more pertinent to next month is Marble Hornets, which was an ARG/web series about Slenderman. Now, we've covered a lot of examples. I do want to point out six specific details that are kind of key to ARGs, the pillars of ARGs, that we've sort of talked about already, but I just want to put them in writing. So there is This Is Not a Game, which is pretty much that the NPCs, if you will not refer to it as a game. The puppet masters, the people putting on the game, they'll have characters or details that they'll say is real. And to the players, it may or may not be obvious that it's part of the game, but something like in The Beast that you have web pages for robotic therapists. And that's, it's never brought to attention, this is part of The Beast for Steven Spielberg's AI. It's just kind of assumed, the NPCs are saying it's real. The players might, maybe not. Also, usually if players are interacting directly with NPCs by, talking to them, then typically the NPCs will only give answers in character, and players are often asked to sort of ask questions in character. I've definitely seen examples where, when somebody asks a question in character as if the game was real, the NPC was more cooperative.
Yeah.
Additionally, there is This Is Not a Hoax, which is saying that, it's not only a fake hoax. Ong's hat was sort of a hoax in that it was sort of a made-up urban legend. But ARGs, they make it obvious to people who play ARGs that they are a puzzle. So, the existence of the next point makes it pretty obvious to people that it is an ARG and not just, a fake story made to trick you. The next point being rabbit holes, which is pretty much just the existence of small signposts that point you toward the rest of the ARG. The entry points for the puzzle or the game. In The Beast case, it was that billboard or movie posters that listed, therapists for robots, stuff like that. For Nine Inch Nails Year Zero, it was the cassettes in the bathrooms. stuff like that. Sort of a thing to say, hey, there's an ARG going on.
Yeah.
There is interactivity, story events, and world events that happen with the players, not in spite of them. And usually the players will have some impact on the story. There are puzzles, which are anything from real-life tasks to ciphers and clues. And then there is designing for a crowd, which is the design principle that you are not meant as one person to solve the ARG. This isn't like a solo experience you sit down and do in your spare time. This is like something that communities are meant to form around. In a lot of the ones mentioned by 42 Entertainment, this was like literal large person events that were held in person. But a lot of times nowadays, it's also just like, especially cryptic puzzles that require a lot of minds to either decipher or come up with ideas on how to break.
Now that we've defined what is an ARG, we can also sort of define a little bit of what's not exactly an ARG, because there's a lot of, as ARGs got slightly more normalized, and I don't use that in a derogatory sense, I just sort of use that as like, as ARG media kind of became more popular, I feel like it also had an impact on theory media. Things like, you know, Five Nights at Freddy's, or like Undertale with, you know, Gaster. And so ARGs are not, like, ARGs can be theory media, but theory media is not by default an ARG.
Yeah. So I think a way to put it is that, like, a lot of web series, like, you know, series made for the internet or made on the internet, they involve some amount of, like, mystery that you might need to piece together yourself to understand the full plot. But piecing the plot together does not make it an ARG.
Yeah. So, like, an example I want to bring up is The Walton Files. The Walton Files is a, like, 3-4 YouTube video that effectively tell a story heavily inspired by Five Nights at Freddy's. If you feel like looking it up, major trigger warning. It is spooky media, but also, like, it has grotesque scenery and stuff. But it isn't, like, something where you find ciphers and go to alternate links. There's, I think, exactly one example where, like, a YouTube link pops up for, you know, a frame, and it has, you know, its own small video that's, like, 2 minutes. But the contents of the series, the web series, is just, like, 4 to 5 YouTube videos that you watch and then sort of, like, piece together the mystery of, you know, what these supernatural goings-on are. But that's not an ARG.
Yeah. And also, like, I think there are web series that have, like, while they were ongoing, they would release puzzles, and then the plot would be progressed in future installments, but, like, they are able to be experienced as a series without doing puzzles. So, like, an example would be Cat Ghost, was one where, like, every episode they released had its own, like, little executable minigame you could play that would have secrets and stuff hidden. But also, now that it's finished, you could watch it all the way through and probably get enough out of it. But, like, while it was ongoing, they had this whole puzzle setup going on.
Yeah.
I think also a good example would be the difference between unedited footage of a bear and This House Has People in It.
Yeah.
Both by Wham City Comedy, which apparently also makes horror. Unedited footage of a bear has bonus content online relating to it, but, like, it doesn't, it's not really, it's like a point and click adventure sort of thing you do on the, like, website for it, but there isn't much other interaction with the world other than going to the website. And the only real puzzle you have to do is notice that the website in the commercial, quote-unquote, is a real website. Whereas This House Has People in It has not only a website, but also, like, passwords you have to figure out to access more content on that website. And so it's a bit closer to ARG because the puzzles are a bit more involved.
Yeah. And it should also be noted that, like, That isn't necessarily a criticism. Like,
yeah,
all of these are effectively value neutral. Especially when it comes to like independent creators, it is certainly easier to make something that is more like a you know, theory creating, or you know, a like semi ARG elements into just sort of like a you know, otherwise just like, again, I'm gonna be saying theory building series, but like, you know, imposing these ideas into something that is just otherwise a web series is, it's a fun way to build texture to that series effectively.
Yeah.
And so, like, you don't have to make something massively in-depth in order to be a, like, true ARG. You can have, like, minor elements. Things that we will be talking about next month, especially.
Yeah, I think ARGs is sort of a spectrum rather than a binary. Basically, I'm saying you can be non-binary ARG.
Non-bay-ARG-nary.
Sure, we'll workshop it. So, in 2010, Valve updated the game Portal, which released in 2007. I know it released in 2007 because that was a fucked year for video games, in a good way. So, in 2010, Valve updated Portal, specifically the Steam version, adding radios to every test chamber. Portal being a first-person shooter puzzle game where you shoot portals onto walls to solve puzzles. I'm going to assume you're familiar with it for the rest of the episode. When players put the portals in certain spots on each test chamber, there was a weird sort of signal that was beeped. And people found that the audio file that would play had both Morse code and SSTV images, which is a form of transmitting images through audio. The images led to a BBS number that prompted a login screen when accessed, and the login screen, logging in with a password from the Morse code, gave you it gave like art of Portal and quotes from Cave Johnson. And shortly afterward, Portal was updated with a post-credit scene of the main character Chell being dragged back inside Aperture Science. That was the first acknowledgement of Portal 2. So, what followed in April 1st, 2011 is the ARG that led to the release of Portal 2, and that's what this episode is about. The Potato Sack Pack.
Yes, if you looked at the title of this episode and were like, oh man, I can't wait for them to talk about Irish agriculture, I'm very sorry, that's a different episode.
Yeah, we'll talk about the potato famine some other time.
Yeah.
So, the Potato Sack Pack was a pack on Steam of 13 indie games. If you, do you have those handy?
I believe I can, yes. The 13 indie games were 1, 2, 3, Kick It, A Reckless Disregard for Gravity, Amnesia, The Dark Descent, A Machine for Pigs was not part of the Amnesia anything at this point, Audio Surf, Bit Trip Beat, Cogs, Defense Grid, Killing Floor, Portal, not Portal 2, sorry, Rush, Super Meat Boy, The Ball, The Wonderful End of the World, and Toki Tori, and slightly also related, I believe, was Team Fortress 2.
Actually, TF2 was unrelated. They had references to potatoes, but it didn't have any significance to the pack or the ARG.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, the Potato Sack Pack was these 13 indie games, and On the day it released, April 1st, a bunch of updates were added to every game that involve references to potatoes, if you would believe it or not. But studious players noticed that on some of these, there were these images of, they came to be known as glyphs. For example, there were some potatoes in some of the games. I think Rubik's Rush had one or two that had, like, a potato that had this, like, square image on it that had some sort of small iconography on it. This, like, monochrome image, flat colors, brief, like, outlined sort of vector art. One on Super Meat Boy's new, like, player-made level select looked a bit like Mono from Audio Surf. Audio Surf being a music game where you could play any song. Players started playing songs from the Super Meat Boy soundtrack in Audio Surf. When playing the Ballad of Lil Slugger, with an apostrophe, a giant potato would appear near the end of the level, and if it was played perfectly, the potato would display a glyph that looks like the logo for Rubik's Rush. And so people learned that the glyphs match the games in the pack. And there was a chain leading from Meat Boy to Audio Surf to Rush. The other very important game on April 1st is Tokitori, which is a puzzle game where you control a cute little chicken. Very good game, highly recommend. It was updated with some levels just called Test, and they involve shower curtains as a new item you could use. Shower curtains being a reference to the lore of Portal, in that Aperture Science used to make showers and shower curtains. One level had lights in the like walls of the terrain that looked a bit like Braille characters, which, it turns out, transcribed to be the coordinates of the headquarters of Two Tribes, the developer for Tokitori and Rush. So one user, Jake R., traveled there and found a bag of potatoes inside their window with a glyph written on it. The potato had a W, and then another potato had sort of like a quarter of a gear, which presumably was meant to match up with the game Cogs. Also, outside the building, there was a telephone pole, and on the telephone pole was a picture. Jake R. climbed the pole and pulled down a picture, a printed, like, white paper piece. It had a picture of a swan painting something, and also on it was the phrase, "Art for swans is dope. I sauce age a taco." And that was the events of April 1st, as that established the mystery going in to the rest of the pack. April 5th, Valve released a new trailer for Portal 2. This trailer had a few frames that had some probably important info for the ARG. One frame referenced 16 glyphs and 13 ciphers. Now, we've talked about the glyphs before. Ciphers, you might have an idea of what it is, but keep them in mind. Now, as people started playing a few more of the games, some people found that in one level of 1-2-3 Kick It, there was a string of words that said Sandy may or may not be fictional. When people googled this, they found a blog by someone named Sandy, and she mentioned her house getting broken in. She also mentioned someone named Hubert Uberson, her boss. Note that if you spell the word Hubert Uberson, the word tuber is kind of in there, cryptic crossword style. She also mentioned her friend Steve, a raccoon. In there were potatoes you could kiss in-game using a kiss action to learn potato facts. However, one possible fact was a set of 4 3-word strings. And thanks to some things that were said by Sandy, those strings were turned out to be URLs sent through URL shorteners. I think TinyURL was the one they mainly used.
Yeah.
Inputting them
It was things like Crime Flyer Intimidator.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Crime Flyer Intimidator, Crime Flyer Inventor. I'm getting Discord pinged. Hopefully that's not too loud. Most of these led to videos by Long Jumper, which was Steve's YouTube channel. They showed Steve playing and a number of them had some billboards that were different from most of the other billboards in the game. The billboards had other links to later videos. I think the first one was like Proxy Prossy Orangutan or something, which led to one video of the video game. And then there was like Proxy Prossy Flamingo, and just this whole chain of animal named URL shortened videos. Also, each video had a billboard containing a grid of letters that, when combined, gave the phrase Lo-Fi Wave Tossed. It is a sad hoop game. Additionally, Steve linked to his photo bucket, which had a picture of another glyph, the glyph being one of Tokitori sitting down, and he commented that he saw it a lot on his morning commute to work, and that it was always drawn with a letter V nearby. So, from this and the potatoes that Jake R. found, you might be able to notice that the glyphs are next to a letter. Keep that in mind. Crime Flyer Intimidator, which was also found in The Wonderful End of the World, had a video of Sandy's house getting broken into, and the video showed a glyph of Meat Boy's face. Later on the blog, Sandy started talking about her boss Hubert. People found a Twitter page for Hubert, where he talked about his missing brother Rube. Rube T. Uberson.
Rube's Twitter was found where he mentioned the phrase, oil you above eyes, so be bossy, a hobo yam? Later on, though, Sandy's blog post disappeared, and she began tweeting from Hubert's account. The last major update of the 5th was the game Defense Grid, a tower defense game, that they added a login page, a whole console to the main menu. Almost like a dev console, except not. Accessing the console as a guest sent the player through a text adventure game, and solving that unlocked a new campaign of the story mode of Defense Grid, which was, I think, just like one or two levels. If you beat it on impossible difficulty, it gave you the phrase, wife ire, avoid evil maidens, be good, okay? Also, the level was shaped like a QR code. The QR code was a lead, it was a string of characters that was a password for one of the users in the console. His account in the console had 4 files, which led to another username and password, and so forth. Then, 2 days later, April 7, the next big phase of the ARG began. Killing Floor updated with 5 new achievements displaying glyphs. These had the glyphs for Killing Floor, which was, I believe, like a radioactive symbol. Bit Trip, which was a dot. Ah, which was a guy falling. Audio Surf, which again was mono. And Razer, the company that makes hardware. These glyphs had garbled descriptions that went sent through a cipher with a certain key, revealed messages that gave the letters for those glyphs. They had, like, missing letters in front of them, in front of certain words. And the missing letter was just the letter for the glyph. A Defense Grid update linked to a video of Jake R. climbing the pole in front of the Tokitori office. Remember that? This is one of my favorite parts. So, it has just a video taken from, like, across the street at, like, a cafe. Now, during the video, as Jake R. is climbing the pole, a truck passes by the camera. And on the side of the truck was a set of glyphs, which translated to flip until the dots match, but without the vowels. Now, how do they translate the glyphs? Well, you might have noticed that all the glyphs have a letter associated, so you might be able to put two and two together, and if you have like a library of the glyphs, you can match them up with letters. But I love this because it means they had a truck ready with this on the side, in case somebody came to their office and they were ready to film. I think they must have been watching like the IRC channel because so all the info about the ARG was collected on a wiki, a like Potato Fool's Day wiki, and they had an IRC channel to discuss the hunt. And so whenever I mention IRC, that's sort of what I'm referring to, which for you Zoomers stands for Internet Relay Chat. It's like Twitch chat, but without the video.
Or the slurs, sometimes.
Ooh, yeah. Well, sometimes.
Sometimes being the operative word.
I'd say it hasn't really changed. Now, so yeah, I believe they were watching and they saw that JCAR was planning on going there. But yeah, it's just wild. So the flip until the dots match referred to a level in Tokitori that had a bunch of dots that were like little lights again, but if you were to flip them around, it would turn into what looked like a QR code that sent players to a zip file. The file had 3 images, and these images were like people trapped in a room full of pipes, sort of a creepy camera vibe is what they call it on the wiki, but the images also had some pseudocode on them, you know, things that look like code but are not code. Overlaying the code onto the image circled some letters, and those letters were circled using brackets and curly braces. That acted as a method of numbering each letter that was circled, which, when anagrammed together using that order, spelt movable panels. Remember movable panels. Speaking of movable panels, Cogs is a sliding puzzle game where you slide squares around to fix machines. You, like, move pipes around. It's like those 15 puzzles where it's like the numbers 1 through 15 and you have to slide them around in order by moving squares around. It's like that.
Yeah.
Cogs was updated with a level called the Best Laid Schemes, which had a bunch of glyphs on the tiles and no further info. Now, before the 7th, people brute forced it, as in like they just kind of ran a program to try every combination. And when they did so, they were brought to a login screen for Aperture Science. Of course, as they like tried this again after a little time had passed, it was removed. But now it's kind of presumed that they got there too early without actually solving the puzzle. And so they took it down for a bit. But on the 7th, people started finding more login screens. Each login screen in each game required some sort of password. Not any sort of like username or anything. But they all prompted like a password for Aperture Science. At the same time as this, a bunch of admins of different community groups and then some like journalists from different gaming news websites started receiving emails from Gabe Newell. Each email had itself an image, which was like part of a larger image, kind of a jigsaw puzzle style, and it also had ASCII numbers on it. Each image also had an anagram of reboot process in the name of it, arranging the images that were gained all together like a puzzle showed an image of a bathysphere, which kind of looks like one of the personality cores from Portal. And the ASCII numbers created two messages. The first one was emancipating something early, and the second one was 4/19/2011 equals 4/15/2011 as like dates. Later on that day, Hubert tweeted a picture of a paper flower with a code on it. The code translated to Morse, which gave another message. That message was for a link shortener that led to an encoded zip file. Later that day, JR got an email with an OGG file attached that had a password hidden in its spectrogram. A spectrogram being like, honestly, I don't really know the definition of it. It's just like a way you can visualize audio?
Yeah, a spectrogram like splits audio into different frequencies. You don't get a lot of use out of it unless you're like
trying to leave a hidden message.
Basically.
Yeah.
You know, now that I've said that, we're going to get like every single listener is actually going to be like secretly a spectrogramographer, and it's going to be like, actually, they're extremely useful in like coal mining, and it's like, cool.
Yeah, I think that would be cool. Some hidden use for spectrograms.
Yeah.
So, the password given from the spectrogram analysis was used on that zip file from the paper flower, and that gave a new song called Searching Emergence Discovery. Playing that song on Kick-It led to a login screen. Ooh, that's two login screens now. The OGG file's name was also the file of a Google account, or the name of a Google account, and that account uploaded a picture of the ARG's IRC channel, which also gave instructions on how to access a secret level in The Wonderful End of the World. Beating that level led to that game's login screen. Now, since Defense Grid was last sort of touched on, they added some new puzzles. These are my other favorite part of the hunt. So, the geniuses at Hidden Path, they added two puzzles under the most recently found, like, account in their console. One puzzle involved turning flowers into alchemical symbols, and then turning those into atomic weights, and then using the atomic weights to index into messages that spelled out a password. Indexing is a puzzle hunt term for taking a number and using that to find the nth letter in a phrase, where n is that number. So, like, if you were to index the word bat for 3, you would get T, because it's the third letter in bat.
Okay.
That password used on a console directory called Flower Answer gave a new file, and that file highlighted the phrase troubled memories, along with some lore. But who cares about lore? We have puzzles to solve. Like, the other puzzle, which was a set of, I want to say, 9 mosaic images of, like, rectangular shapes, all in sort of a square grid that seemingly had no correlation. They were like gray, blue, red, and yellow rectangles. After some confusion, the developers of Defense Grid, Hidden Path, invited some solvers to their office, and the solver that appeared was given Legos of the same colors of the mosaics. That's when they realized that the mosaics were pointing to layers of Legos that, when constructed, made a cube made of Legos. Now, there is a file in one of the directories in Defense Grid's console that was talking about how somebody can't see the color yellow, and that was a hint to remove all the yellow Legos from the cube. Doing this created differently shaped structures that were no longer cubes. But they did look like a map from the Defense Grid console of like an office complex. And if you were to align the remaining Lego shapes with their respective buildings in the right spot and viewed them from the side, the holes in the shapes would spell out the word "no cake," which was a password for the Defense Grid console. Using it in the console gave another name and password for another user in the console.
Jesus Christ.
But this user was the last one. They had a file that asked users to sign up for recruitment. When players signed up for recruitment, they were given multiple random traits, and they were told two traits that they were looking for, and the community had to collaboratively find players with those traits and have them recruit. The other file was a game of Nim, which is the game where you have a number of stones, and you and your opponent take turns taking away one or two stones. And I believe it's that you don't want to be the last person to take it, or you do. Either way, it is a game that can be mathematically solved. And what players did is they opened two instances of Defense Grid, and they started the game on both of them. You could choose whether you wanted to be player one or player two. So they would start one game in player one, one in player two, and they would just copy the moves that the AI did on both games. So you basically had the AI play itself. You would look at the one where you're player two, see what the AI's first move was, do that on the one where you're player one, see what the AI's first move was, do that on the one where you're player two, back and forth.
That's really clever.
And when you beat that game, you get a login screen. Killing Floor's login screen, you just reach by getting a large amount of money in-game, and players accidentally guessed the password for it based on some posters that pointed to one of the game's levels. The password was failed experiments, and it worked. When input, it gave a potato icon on the user's Steam profile. It placed a potato there, and it updated the game. This didn't appear to have any impact on the game, but when looking at the game's files, players found a password-protected RAR. People also found that the session logs for Killing Floor held the phrase "ugly truths," and one of the characters in the game had a bio that was updated to say, "One's sofa have deep counts as I die." Now, by now, players had found most of the glyphs, between the ones that were found in-games, the ones that were found on real-life potatoes, and the ones in the Killing Floor achievements list. People pretty much had a glyph for every letter. Almost every letter. They didn't have the five least used consonants in the English language, and there were no vowels. But people found that they could turn the cogs, or the glyphs, squares in the cogs puzzle into letters, and they could use those letters to spell out the phrase, "Of mice and men go oft awry," without the vowels. This is because the level was called The Best Laid Schemes, and so you're just finishing the quote. Now that they had the correct login, or the correct solution, they were able to find their way into the login screen. Players also noticed that there was a level in Cogs with a jack-in-the-box, and what was previously just like a solid ring around the jack-in-the-box's eye had a Morse code and like a sort of barcode-looking style. And that code said every piece. Let's talk about amnesia. See, so a lot of these puzzles were being solved kind of concurrently. And so I'm trying to just kind of jump around in the way that lets me talk about them all at once. But a lot of these were solved over the course of kind of a long period of time between September 7th and September 11th. Sorry, hold on. April 7th and April 11th. They were solved sort of along a period from April 7th to April 11th. And so, like, I'm not necessarily talking about these in chronological order, but I sort of am, but I'm also doing it kind of loosely.
We don't have time to get into the biggest ARG that the U.S. government has ever set up on us. No,
I was going to cut that out, but now I have to leave it in for context.
You do.
So Amnesia had four files in its updates on the Potato Fool's Day. These were all RAR files, and all were password protected. Now, Frictional Games, the devs of Amnesia, actually had sort of a little storyline going on of their own. This involved a robot named Helper, H-E-L-P-R, that was being held captive by Frictional Games. And Helper was posting on the IRC channel about just, like, you know, any like, suggestions, asking for help escaping from Frictional. And Helper said that they overheard the devs saying that they would need a blue note to solve some of the puzzles in the RARs. People found this blue note under a staircase in a level of Amnesia. The blue note had phrases and hieroglyphs, like actual Egyptian hieroglyphs. The phrases all corresponded to Lovecraftian elder gods, or like Lovecraftian monsters, and they also all had numbers associated. Indexing the names of the gods with the numbers gave a string of characters that, when arranged in order, based on the hieroglyphs, gave the password to the first RAR. The RAR kind of just led through like a chain of anagrams and hidden words that would give the next password, where the next RAR would have another password and chain of hidden words and so forth. All of these were kind of hidden in image files through different methods. Like, I think one of them you had to, what's it called? Like, invert the colors? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's like the I don't know what it's called.
Like, up the contrast or something.
It's like where you make it the opposite color. So, like, white becomes black.
Oh, yeah, that's just invert the colors.
Yeah. So yeah, this led to a phrase, an airplane can lift from there, sure, and a map of a level from Rush, with tiles arranged in a specific area. People found that loading in that level in Rush and putting those tiles in that way led to the login screen for Rush. Rush is a puzzle game that's sort of like Choo Choo Rocket? Or I guess Deltarune Chapter 2, if you will. It's one of those where like you place tiles with arrows down, and automatically moving cubes would follow those arrows, and you had to get them to certain points.
Yeah.
The solution given through the Amnesia, hidden file, it would make you drop cubes off the side of the map, which obviously would normally lead to a fail state. So, you can imagine why that would be hidden. Now, Rush itself hid letters and numbers on the bottom of each level, because you could kind of move the camera around. Except for a new level called Key to Success, and then also, some levels had EOT there instead. This is pretty cool. So, the letters referred to a difficulty, and the numbers were coordinates of a level on the map screen. If you think of, I think it's that Key to Success had the, like, origin of 0, 0, then every level would have its own coordinates. Other numbers index the level titles. And so when you follow a path from Key to Success to one of the EOT levels, you would pass through a certain amount of levels and their difficulties, and by indexing those levels' titles, you would get a phrase for each EOT level. EOT ended up meaning, like, end of transmission. Doing this, like, maze map through the game gave the code Rail Rider. Now, the last login screen was Super Meat Boys, which was found by dying 11 times on the level 419, which was clued by that ASCII number puzzle from the Bathysphere image. 41911, die 11 times in 419. So, now we have 13 login screens, and we also have 13 passwords. Now, just a fun game for you to play at home. Can you guess which one matches to which login screen? We have Rail Rider, Long Fall, Troubled Memories, Chips Challenge, Movable Panels, Deadly Lasers, Ugly Truth, Failed Experiments, which I already gave the answer to, Conveyor Belts, Death Traps, Weighted Companion, Bird Eggs, and Every Piece.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's play this game. Okay, Ugly Truth is Killing Floor. You've already...
Failed Experiments was Killing Floor.
Fuck, I've already lost.
Well... I'll give you an easy one. Bird Eggs.
Okay, Bird Eggs is probably... Looking through the list of games here. It sucks that I haven't played over half of these games.
Over half of them are pretty good games, though.
The ball?
No.
It has Tokitori.
Yes.
Okay.
The one about the chicken. Tokitori. Right. Bird eggs. Here's another one you might get. Long Fall.
Probably,
Yes, a reckless disregard for gravity. Let's see, where's another one? Movable Panels. I kind of hinted at what this one was.
Movable Panels was, oh shit, you did hint at it. Defense Grid?
No,
Cogs.
Cogs, yes.
Yeah.
In a similar way, you might be able to get what Conveyor Belts is.
That one, I assume, is Defense Grid.
No, that's Rush.
Shit.
The one where you place belts that shift around and convey cubes. Okay. Deadly Lasers. You've said this one already.
Deadly Lasers is going to be Cogs. It's the ball.
This one's Defense Grid.
Fuck. I literally just said Defense Grid. Damn it.
Yeah.
And Cogs was already one.
Yeah. Rail Rider. You might be able to get this one.
Audio Surf?
Yes.
Okay.
Chips Challenge.
Chips Challenge 1-2-3 Kick It?
No, it was Bit Trip, actually, because it's like a chiptune game.
Shit, you're right.
The rest of them, we'll see it. Can you get what Weighted Companion is?
Weighted Companion is Amnesia?
It's the ball.
Fuck.
It's a weighted companion. You carry it around with you.
Damn it.
Ugly Truth.
You literally started with like all of the ones I haven't played and Ugly know Truth. Very little about.
You should know this one. Ugly Truth.
Ugly Truth is Killing Floor.
That's Amnesia.
Fuck.
You said Killing Floor already twice.
I thought that you said...
Okay, we're almost done. What do you have? Death Traps?
Super Meat Boy.
Yes.
What is this, like, three games that I've played?
Wait, hold on. Did I mess this up? No, I didn't mess this up.
Hey, if there's any prospective ARG completers out there...
You know what? Let's just move on.
My phone number is 314.
Oh, no.
Beep, beep, beep. Beep, 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 beep.
All right, so putting in a password into a login screen gave a potato to every player's page that did so, and more RAR archives. All the RARs were questions, and the answer was the password to open it. The questions were usually like based off the game that you got it from. Each archive had a picture of Portal 2 and pictures of places from Seattle. They also had fragments of a final archive, and each archive had a single letter name that could be anagrammed to spell connect the dots. Combining those fragments needed one final password, and the devs of Defense Grid, Hidden Path, suggested this had to do with the 13 ciphers. Here's the cipher puzzle. So, take the ciphers and remove the vowels. This gives you 16 consonants for each cipher. This is because every time the glyphs have appeared, they did so without vowels. In, like, the truck from the video of Jake R. climbing the pole and the Cogs puzzle. So, remove the vowels, you get 16 consonants, arrange those in a 4x4 grid for each cipher, and then remove the S consonant, and remove the glyphs that were the S consonant. The remaining glyphs spell letters that spell the word collaboration. This was the password for the completed fragmented archive from all the RARs. So for a few days, everything seemed kind of quiet. There wasn't a whole lot of updates. But around the time of the 11th, pages from the wiki and IRC users started saying the message, "There's a hole in the sky through which I can fly." There was a moment where Ichiro from Dejoban Games went missing, quote-unquote, sending some cryptic messages. Over time, games were updated with more Portal-themed content, and beating those contents led to new login screens that played soundbites. All these soundbites were, they were like GLaDOS talking about locations around Seattle. One of like a gorilla eating noodles referenced a place that has a gorilla statue and it's a noodle restaurant, for example. Mapping all those locations in Seattle and connecting them with lines, a la connect the dots, spelled the word Nellypot, which was a real steam group. Joining that gave one more potato, and this is the only potato I have from the ARG. The owner of the group was Dinosaur, which was a reference to the previous ARG from Portal 1. If you go to their page, it had screenshots of what looked like Portal 1, but opening them would actually be a screenshot of Portal 2. Each screenshot also had some tiles in the background that could be connected to form, you guessed it, a QR code. And that code led to a countdown page and a website. Later on, the website was updated to show the final date, Tuesday, April 19th, 2011, and a message from GLaDOS asking for help rebooting. It also had progress bars for all the games in the pack, and a progress bar of total potatoes collected. People quickly found out that just playing the games in the pack and collecting potatoes filled the bars that sped up the progress bar, and that sped up the countdown itself, and that finally ended in GLaDOS rebooting and Portal 2 being released on April 18th, 2011, to much fanfare.
So, if I'm reading this correctly, real-life people collecting these potatoes actually, like, sped up the date at which Portal 2 was released.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes. Portal 2 was released a day early because people found potatoes in games and also just played the games in the pack. So, in, like, postmortems about the ARG, people have talked about how this was instigated by Valve, but pretty much produced by the devs of the game itself. Valve said they would offer any, like, assets that the team would need, but they wanted the developers to come up with the integration and everything.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's really interesting because you could really see how different devs went about working on it, or, like, went about implementing the ARG. Some devs had really, really complex puzzles, like Hidden Path that made Defense Grid. They had some great ones. And Two Tribes that made Tokitori and Rush. They had a lot of, like, hidden ciphers in their levels. I didn't even mention the fake level 6 of their updated files, where the one in the update was impossible to beat. And so you had to open a RAR that had the real level 6. Some of them went with more of a narrative approach. This is probably most notable with Dejoban, who made 1-2-3 Kick It, A Reckless Disregard for Gravity, and The Wonderful End of the World. They had the whole storyline with Sandy and Hubert and Steve, and those were kind of disconnected from the other games, but they really focused on the Dejoban releases. And then there was also like a hybrid style that Frictional did that had both a character that players interacted with and it had, you know, puzzles. And then some had barely any interactivity. Killing Floor was kind of notorious during this because they kind of gave away the ciphers and the glyphs really easily in things that like were pretty easy to check and didn't really have a whole lot of complex puzzles.
Yeah, and then the phrase for them was literally just Mr. Foster's description.
Yeah, and then also,
I said one sofa have deep counts as I die.
Yeah, and then also the way to get the login screen wasn't super complex. It was just basically play the game for a long time to get enough money. And the fact that people accidentally guessed the login password was another thing. But during the ARG, they posted like this really passive aggressive message of like, no, come back. There's more puzzles, guys. There's more puzzles. Everybody come back. Like they were mad that people weren't playing Killing Floor when there were other puzzles and other games left to solve, and they barely had a puzzle for their own content anyways. Also, some puzzles are still unsolved from what I can tell. The ball, Weighted Companion, I think, was guessed, and it's, I don't know if there was a way found to actually get the password, but also during the ball sort of portion of the ARG, they had this, like, I don't know how to put it, like this illustrated manuscript that you could piece together like a puzzle. and it had all these messages and images displayed, but I don't think there was any major progress made on what those contributed to. Now, Now, one thing I think is super cool is that there were a lot of cross-reference based puzzles where, like, you had to do one thing in one game and that would help you in another game. This was kind of done in the puzzles where the devs didn't have as much, like, either room to implement puzzles in their games, or they just kind of didn't add a billion puzzles. So, for example, like, the music-based games, Audio Surf and Kick It, those were a prime area to, like, make puzzles in. You know, the fact that it kind of started with playing a song from Super Meat Boy in Audio Surf to then get a glyph from Rush is kind of a good example of what I mean. Another one is the fact that there was a solution to a puzzle in Rush that was actually the reward for a puzzle in Amnesia. And then also, every login password and glyph was found in a different game, except I think Killing Floor is technically. But every login password was found in a different game than the one it was for. So every like puzzle eventually kind of led you through other games in the pack, which added to this element of, like, you know, sure, like, Super Meat Boy, Audio Surf, Bit Trip, Killing Floor, those were pretty well-regarded indie games at the time. You know, this being 2011, it was still kind of early in the indie game boom. But the others weren't super well-known, especially, like, the Dejoban stuff. I had barely heard anything about them until the pack dropped.
Yeah.
And so by having this, like, cross-promotion type deal, it really encouraged people to play the other indie games. And the final reboot itself was just to play every video game in the pack. And so it ended up bringing a lot of visibility to a lot of the included games that people might have otherwise skipped over. A lot of challenges in these games. So, like, for example, one of the balls, I think it's login password, was found by kind of having a certain... It was like, you have to be this much distance from the ball, with this much time on the timer, with this much health, so on and so forth. And that was something that you could just download a save file for. There were a few other things that you could do that similarly, like, I think the Best Laid Schemes puzzle in COGS, you could technically download a save file for. There's a few other things like that. And so, while some of them definitely encouraged you to, like, learn the game and improve at the game, a lot of them could just be kind of, you know, you could just download a save file from somebody else, but that does follow the collaborative, like, ethos of ARG solving, that by somebody playing a save file from somebody else, they are collaboratively working together on this puzzle or this experience.
Yeah, This is such an interesting, like, piece of history, because, like, Valve is a good developer, generally. Valve is an alright, like, alright distributor. They're a good developer, and they are they were, at the very least, pretty damn good about, like, supporting small, weird, experimental bullshit. And so, like, this feels very peak good Valve.
Yeah.
Of, like, putting together this, you know, collaboration, a mix of well-known stuff and really, like, more obscure sort of indie games, and sort of, like, combining them all together for the ultimate goal of releasing Portal 2.
Yeah, Portal 2 was huge, by the way. Like, Portal 1 was a cool puzzle game that was super highly regarded when it came out. That was like a student project turned into a full video game by Valve. But, like, Portal 2 was kind of unprecedented when it was first announced. And this was, like, the ultimate build-up for the hype.
Yeah, like, Portal 1 is a critical darling. Portal 2 was a critical and commercial darling.
Yeah.
And so, like, this sort of interesting marketing tactic of, like, allowing the players to actually get it to release early by playing other games is, like, it's something that we don't really see a whole lot of anymore. Not that there aren't ARGs still.
Yeah, I was going to say, so So Valve has done a number of ARGs since this, not as like community driven as far as like other like game developers, but they've done a bunch in TF2. There was like a whole Sherlock Holmes update for, I want to say Meet the Medic, the Medic update. There was a bunch of them for like the Steam winter sales and summer sales. I think a specific one was like a whole winter sale ARG type thing that led to the creation of Game Detectives, which is sort of a community of ARG solvers that I think is still active. Also, a lot of the devs involved in the Potato Sack Pack took that experience and later did their own ARGs. The notable ones being like Frictional Games, who did ARGs for a lot of their later releases. Edmund McMillan, a name that's hard to say fast, that he did one for The Binding of Isaac that has a really funny story attached to it as well. That's also sad, but funny. So yeah, the devs who were involved definitely kind of used their knowledge going forward for their own sort of promotion. And I do want to give a mention to Frog Fractions 2, aka the Frog Fractions 2 ARG, the ARG leading up to the release of Frog Fractions 2, aka Frog Fractions 3, which is a whole other episode. But that was an ARG that involved 26 different indie games. And so it was sort of a spiritual successor to the Potato Sack Pack, because it encouraged players to play all these different indie games to find clues and secrets. The power of detectives in this case. So, like, I think it's very easy to get cynical about ARGs because they can be viewed oftentimes as marketing first, especially the big stuff, like the 42 Entertainment stuff. But for one thing,
I will specifically say that I went to 42 Entertainment's website trying to find anything about Last Call Poker some time ago, and a lot of ARGs that they've done have been like Ford Fusion.
Yeah,
like it's been a lot of like you know, car companies and stuff you don't really think about with. with ARGs.
Well, so there is a successful ARG ran by the creators of the Blair Witch Project for Audi. Is that how you pronounce it? Audi? I think it's Audi.
A-U-D-I, yeah. Audi.
And I think that's why there's all these car ARGs. It's because there is one successful one for cars.
A-car-Gs.
Yeah. But I think, for one thing, a good ARG is a really unique experience that, you know, understandably brings a ton of people together for some good, just good fun puzzle solving. And the feeling of like, you know, keeping up with the updates, even if you're not actively solving it, just like learning about what people have found since then is always a real treat.
Yeah. I didn't talk a whole lot during the explanation because, I don't know a whole lot about it. I don't know a whole lot about specifically the Potato Sack Pack. And so it was kind of a fun learning experience for me and you both, listener. But to sort of interject, like, why I think ARGs are more than marketing, video game secrets are so blasé nowadays. And don't get me wrong, that's good things. Like, you know, I think that is a good thing in terms of, like, you know, archival purposes and things like that. Cracking video games is not a hard thing to do. But because of that, we kind of live, like, we've been living in a post, you know, Mew under the truck era for a very long time.
Oh, my God. This gets into the funny but sad story about Binding of Isaac.
Yeah, like, if I remember correctly, didn't, like, Crackers basically crack the ARG in, like, less than a day? And Edmund McMillan was like, cool,
yeah,
please don't.
So the ARG was to unlock the character The Lost, and data miners found out how to do it before the ARG was really underway that long. And so Edmund McMillan added an item called the Data Miner to the game, which is just, like, the worst active item you could get. It, like, lowers your stats and gain stats, but it lowers more than it gains. and it also messes up the graphics in the room, so it's hard to navigate. So, yeah, that's the funny part.
That's amazing.
But yeah, we're in like a post-rumor world, almost.
Yeah, and so like ARGs like exist and are still popular because they are a really fun, wonderful example of like still being able to have that like cracking experience without in a post-internet age. And like I think that holds with like much easier ones, like the one that I'm excited to talk about next week or in a couple weeks, next month, is like not difficult per se, but it's still really fun because like it gives an experience that you can't really have otherwise, and it fills that need, that niche of, you know, playground rumors, of you know, not knowing something about a video game.
So
yeah,
so one of my favorite video games of all time that I don't necessarily recommend you play is The Witness. And spoiler alert for The Witness, the like ultimate reward for doing the hardest challenge in the game is a lecture by Brian Moriarty called The Secret of Psalm 47. So 47? I think it's 46. Secret of Psalm 46. Maybe 47. I don't remember. I think it's 46. So this lecture is kind of long. It's really good, though. Even if you don't own the game The Witness, you can just look it up on YouTube, and it's very enjoyable. It is basically, it's like a lot of short stories about things like his time working at Radio Shack and how people would go in for free batteries and nothing else, even though the batteries were at like the back of the store. And then he talks about like Shakespeare conspiracies, and how people think that Shakespeare was more than one person, and it was a pseudonym used by a group. Or he talks about how like there was the book Masquerade, which was a children's book that the illustrations had like a treasure hunt to them, and that like it was this big, big fad about people trying to find the treasure in Masquerade, and the book became a bestseller because of that. And basically, the lecture is about ultimately that people like mysteries and they like detective work, you know? People like to solve puzzles.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes things like this or things like Mew Under the Truck so compelling, that like it's fun to have a unknown that you can safely interact with and try to figure out what it is. It's not like a fear of the unknown. It is something that you think you can solve, but if you don't, that's kind of okay. But it is enjoyable to think about what it could be. I think nowadays, the equivalent to like Mew Under the Truck is like Gaster or Purple Guy or Herobrine. I think a lot of like, not millennials, but like Millennium Z, the hybrid between millennials and Gen Z, criticize younger people for like getting too enraptured in those like characters and the theories and stuff, but it's hard for me to view them in a different context than something like the Potato Sack Pack or Mew Under the Truck or, you know, what have you, playground rumors. It's just on the internet instead of the playground.
Yeah, it's the first of all, my roommate has texted me the absolute train wreck of the Sombra ARG for Overwatch. So if you want a example of how not to do an ARG, look up the Sombra ARG. But to get back on point, it's theory building is a like fun way to engage with ARG like elements, but without the difficult puzzle aspect. And while we are going like, well, we're going to have a spectrum of things we're going to talk about. And so, like, the thing that I think still makes it worthwhile is just that theory building requires a massively different skill set. Like, ARGs, most of the time, require, you know, cipher knowledge, require, you know, spectrograph knowledge. They require a lot of like skills, but theory building requires sort of like literary theory and, you know, like understanding character motivations, understanding, you know, how to piece together like histories, little things like that. And so I think the reason that no matter how much we can dunk on things like game theory or, you know, I can slightly roll my eyes at like Deltarune Chapter 2 theories being out literally 2 days after Deltarune Chapter 2, spoiling one of the characters for me. Thank you, Swanky Box.
More like Janky Box.
More like Spanky Box.
Oh no.
I still can't, like, you know, get terribly upset at that, because it's like, well, I'm engaging in Deltarune theories, you know? Like, I'm, like, the difference between, you know, a game theory video and, like, sitting there and going, you know, I bet that the twist is going to be XYZ is just one of them is a YouTube video.
Yeah. So basically, stop theory shaming people.
Yeah. Although, do shame game theory.
Yes.
Do shame the YouTube Matt channel. Pat. Yeah. We can MatPat shame.
Do not shame the mathematical study of game theory.
No. Game theory as a mathematical study is really cool.
Shouts out to the proof of the, like, devil's game or whatever it is, where the angel tries to run away from the devil.
Oh, yeah.
A proof for that makes it, or that proof that it was impossible was made pretty recently.
I thought that there was a counterproof that came out that said that with an N of 2, the angel could actually continue forever going based on, like, some kind of maze-solving algorithm.
I don't know. That's kind of outside of the scope of this episode.
Yeah. Anyway, we've been, what was the beautiful name that you came up with that I helped with, for game theory?
Digital interactive media hypothesis?
Yes. Digital interactive media extrapolations.
Yes, DIME. That's right. So that's just a digital interactive media extrapolation. A digital media interactive extrapolation. Thanks for listening. If you want more interactive media extrapolations, digital or analog, you can follow us on Twitter at NetSurferPro on Facebook. On Twitter. You can get updates on when our episodes go up. You can also get teasers at our upcoming episodes. I don't know if I have one handy for our next episode, but maybe I'll come up with something clever. Or at least something okay. But if you want to see our next episode, when it comes out, you can also follow us on any podcasting platform. You know, Spotify, iTunes, you name it, we're probably on there. And, you can give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review. Love to hear your feedback. You can also send us your feedback through our Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at MattCraigGaming, where I talk about what I'm playing, what I'm doing, what I've got going on, any updates on, like, projects I'm working on. I recently released an album, Hard Punch Light Kick, under the name Photon Punch. So if you like mashup albums, things like the Mouth series or Swoos, which we did an episode on, you can check that out at photonpunch.bandcamp.com. You can also find Photon Punch on SoundCloud for some shorter, single song kind of funny songs. You can follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I play, you know, video games. I play competitive games, roguelites, puzzle games, strategy games. Every Friday, I play Hitman, the World of Assassination trilogy, and people can use channel points to mess with me. And also, recently, I started playing the Outer Wilds Echoes of the Eye DLC, which is super spooky, but super cool. Really cool. Third favorite game.
It's spooky, in fact.
Yeah. I'm running out of breath.
Well, I'll give you a quick pause to say my socials. You can find me on Twitter and on TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at GalenWilson0n. I post my hot takes and sometimes funny videos. My most recent video has done numbers, TM, as they say. Only like 600 of those numbers, but numbers for me. You can find me.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It's like 60 Googles worth of digits. Wait, no, 6 Googles worth. No, 60 Googles. Oh, goodness. Anyway, you can find me on Twitch at Machine Gun Vampire. I probably need to, like, stream a frickin' game or something some of these days. Maybe something that I own. I don't know. Or something I don't own, I guess.
Uh-oh. Don't let them find out.
Oh, no. Damn it. All right, damn it. I have a ROM of Fairly Odd Parents Volume 3. Come after me, Viacom. And you can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube. I've been really heavily thinking of starting up a new series called No Shortage of Patriots, and I really need to make an introduction to that series to explain the name.
Yeah, I don't understand the name, so you better explain it, or else you're gonna have some explaining to do.
And with that, that's my socials. I've been Galen.
And I've been Matt, and I gotta go play Among Us.
Uh-oh. Imposter?
Sus? Sus?
Sussy Baka.